So today on today's Loopcast, episode 9, I have Dr. Rebecca Johnson at Johnson R, and we're talking about ethics on sort of modern warfare, you know, including drones, cyber, and social media. So let's start with drones today, and sort of, you have this great paper that you've published, The Wizard of Oz Goes to War, Unmanned Systems and Counterinsurgency, which I think you bring up important issues that have to do with drone warfare, particularly, defining combatancy, distinction, and sort of proportionality. Mm-hmm. So sort of walk us through, you know, these three themes that you bring out in the paper and sort of how that relates to, you know, the drone and the sort of modern battle space.
Sure. So this is for a chapter that's coming out in Killing by Remote Control. It's an edited volume by B.J. Strasser. It should be coming out sometime this spring with Oxford University Press. And the purpose behind the chapter was there seems to be a good bit of, I don't necessarily want to call it hysteria, but there seems to be a good bit of people reacting to the fact of drones as opposed to thinking through and responding to what is, in essence, a different type of weapon system. When we think of drones, we tend to have Predator in our mind, or Reaper. We think of an armed drone that's aerial. But unmanned systems cross the spectrum of land-based autonomous systems that are used for things like IED detection, road clearing, to aerial vehicles, to underwater subs. And so when we think about this particular type of platform and the restraints we ought to put on its use, it's, for me, being a military ethicist, I think we ought to slow down, catch our breath, and systematically think through how the existing moral restraints we already fight under apply to this different type of platform.
So that makes sense. So, I mean, how do we then, sort of in terms of defining combatancy? So, I mean, the drone is pretty, it's a complex device. I mean, in the sense that you're no longer dealing with an individual on the battlefield, but rather, you know, a robot, and then distance, and then the person controlling the robot. So, I mean, how do we approach a definition of combatancy where, you know, who and who isn't in combat? You know, it seems when we read through, like, Walzer's Just and Unjust Wars, like, he's very much, it's very much a state-based definition, and it's very much, there's people that are in combat, there's people who aren't in combat. But so, with the drone, you know, where do we place the human element? Like, where do we, is he or she in combat, or he's not in combat? Like, it seems like, you know, combatancy, defining who is in combat is a real issue here.
Sure, and it's an issue on two sides of the coin. There's the individual, if we're talking about an unmanned system that's piloted, then the pilot is that individual who's flying the drone, if we want to keep aerial vehicles. Is the person who's flying the drone a combatant, but then also the individual who's being targeted with the weapon on the business end, is that individual a combatant?
Right. Well, I mean, so I mean, you do really bring up an interesting point then. I mean, because drones are really, their use has been heavily in counterinsurgency environments.
Mm-hmm. So now, counterterrorism.
Counterterrorism too, like signature and personality strikes. So I'm curious then. I mean, this has really thrown combatancy for a loop. I mean, because you're not only dealing with the issue of counterinsurgency, so, you know, a combatant who hides among non-combatants, but
right.
Also, I think distinction plays a big part of this too. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, how do we create a paradigm for combatancy then? I mean, do we say soldiers, drones, non-combatants, or, you know, lead us through a construction. Like, how do you as an ethicist approach that situation?
Sure, and again, the reason that I wrote this chapter is because the answer doesn't really differ if we're talking about an unmanned system or if I'm talking about a soldier who's trying to target with his rifle. There's a distinction. There are differences in the way that international law defines combatancy and how military ethicists tend to think of combatancy. At the end of the day, though, the United States isn't bound by military ethicists. They're bound by international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, additional protocols, and customary international law. So they are fairly robust in terms of defining combatancy as either being the soldier of a specific state, or if you have an insurgency that's vying for independence, the additional protocols deal with this, their non-state militias and militaries. There are certain conditions under international law when they would be designated as combatants. The importance for international law with combatancy is who's guaranteed POW status, who warrants POW protection.
So then I'm curious then, when we introduce autonomy into the drone, so you're pushing out the human element. So to be clear, I mean, the human still pulls the trigger, still does...
Today,
know,
right.
Today, the nastier, you know, side of drones. But, I mean, you know, how do we define, you know, what role do we give the autonomous drone? You know, one is that is basically all it does is collect intelligence, you know, it takes off, it collects intelligence, it lands, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we define that under international law, under, you know, ethical paradigms, whatever? I mean, it seems that's really dicey because, you know, clearly the drone's not human, but it, you
sure.
know, it's autonomous enough to, you know, make basic decisions and know where it's going. You know, I'm not saying it's human, but I'm not saying that it's, you know, completely, you know, a dumb robot, so to speak.
Sure. Not to be flip, but clearly the drone's not going to get POW status if it's shot down, right?
Right.
Dirt.
Right.
So then the question becomes, if you're talking about simply an intelligence platform, then it's just an intelligence platform. I can't think through significant moral or ethical concerns other than what the humanitarian community has brought up, which is the use of drones in humanitarian emergencies and potential privacy concerns. I don't know. I don't find that argument compelling. I don't know how central that argument has been in terms of people who work with drones because of the positive benefit that intel
right.
and surveillance would play in the situation of an emergency. Kind of the good outweighs the harm. But if you're thinking about a manned, armed drone that is autonomous without a human in the loop, then there are huge moral and ethical questions about that. Because we know that sometimes we shoot the wrong people. And there's a way that the law and military ethics deals with that, dealing with collateral damage.
So do you think that we'll ever sort of, you know, have weapon systems that are autonomous? Because, I mean, you do bring up a great point, because there's definitely issues of liability. Not just liability, but issues of responsibility and issues of
mm-hmm. accountability.
You know, accountability. I mean,
yeah.
So, I mean, do you think there will ever be a push to sort of make weapon systems autonomous to the point where the robot, you know, is hunting and then also destroying?
Not that there will be, but there is now. Yes.
Right.
So the Army is moving towards autonomy. I don't know when they're going to have that capacity. Right now on the DMZ between North and South Korea, there are land-based autonomous robots that already have the calculations programmed into them that if parameters X, Y, and Z are met, those robots have the capacity to use lethal force. So we're already there. What we haven't done, and I don't believe that those are our robots, I believe those are the South Koreans, what we haven't done is turned the corner and activated that. We haven't turned it on, but all you got to do is flip the switch, and those guys are out there.
So it's already there. So,
yes.
I mean, but...
It's a political, social question about whether we want to turn the corner and engage the capacity we already have.
Okay. So let's talk about the second issue, distinction,
mm-hmm.
which I find it's sort of the thing that sort of is in the media the most, because you do have sort of a lot of, in Yemen especially, you know, signature and sort of
mm-hmm.
personality strikes. So walk us through, you know, the differences. First, sort of help us define, you know, what a signature strike is and what a personality strike is. Because, you know, for a lot of people, you know, a drone strike is a drone strike is a drone strike. And sort of, so, you know, walk us through what a signature strike is and what a personality, or personality in quotes.
Mm-hmm. So a personality strike is when you have collected intel on an individual and by name I know that you are a militant. So under international law, There are those individuals who we know are combatants because they wear a uniform of a country or because they're affiliated with a particular state-run military. We also have two different designations of when you can target someone who doesn't meet those criteria. One is direct participation of hostilities. So if you know that someone is carrying out a hostile act, you can target them with lethal force on their way to the event, while conducting the event, and on their way home. But you may only target them at that moment. So that's the farmer by day, freedom fighter by night. He's fighting at night, you can kill him, but while he's tilling his land, you can't. We also have what's called the continuous combat function, which are those individuals who are so affiliated with the militant organization that they are functionally a member of a militant organization.
So these would be like...
core Al-Qaeda members.
Oh, so I was about to say, so like weapons dealers, like, okay, so...
They would still need to be parties of a conflict. A weapons dealer, like somebody like Victor Boot, he's kind of parasitic, but he's not really a combatant. He's okay. Facilitating, but he's not engaged in.
So really, the definition here is you're limited to whoever's participating or who's, you know, so tied in that they're considered a participant at all times.
Right. Okay. They identify as being a member of the group. So Boot would sell arms to any number of militant organizations. He didn't identify with any one of them.
Okay.
But if you're the head financier for Al-Qaeda... in the Arabian Peninsula, then you would be considered, you would have continuous combat function because you're a self-avowed core member of this organization. So if you're continuous combat function, you're targetable 24/7. So for the personality strikes, that is, I know that individual is a member of that organization.
Right.
I know them by name. I have intel to verify. I can take that person out, either with a drone strike or with a regular soldier or blowing up a building, you know, whatever. It doesn't have to be a drone.
Right.
This signature strike is slightly different. The signature strike says that we have parameters of those individuals who we have a pretty good hunch are part of these organizations. And so when we see an individual, even if we don't have hard intelligence of him participating in hostilities or being self-avowed core member of this militant organization, we've identified him as being a legitimate target as well.
So let's sort of, not switch gears, but sort of look at it in a sort of broader picture, because distinction isn't just about sort of defining who we can kill and who we can't kill, but rather also, you know, civilians from soldiers. So I'm curious, in these strikes then, you know, how do we deal with collateral damage? Because it seems like, you know, when Anwar al-Awlaki was killed, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't just him who was killed, but rather there was, you know, a ton of people around him. I think it was his uncle, his, you know, family members. And also, I mean, I think this problem has really come to sort of, you know, an edge in Pakistan, where, you know, you get the militant, but then you also sort of, you kill 10 to 15 other people in the village. So I'm curious then, you know, how does distinction work under this with drones? I mean, is it really just, you're saying, you know, 20 people, you know, versus the life of this, you know, versus the target of the personality strike? You know, I mean, you know, the popular idea is that drones are supposed to be, you know, clean or not clean, but sort of, you know, limit how much collateral damage is, you know, done, but, you know, how do we integrate collateral damage into our thoughts on drones?
Sure. I would say we don't do it any differently than we do with other weapon systems. So we did, in fact, kill al-Awlaki with a drone. It could have been an F-18. It could have been a Special Forces or a SEAL. It just happened to be that it came from a weapon system where the pilot was not in the plane at the time. But the principle of distinction and collateral damage, I think, is an important one. The argument in favor of using drones for personality strikes. So when I have identified this individual, I know he's like al-Awlaki, an individual who meets the definition of continuous combat function. The president has designated him an enemy to the United States and a legitimate target at all times. For him, you have a drone with ISR, so surveillance capabilities. You can follow him, and you can pick the moment when there is the least possibility for collateral damage. And we do this. We have drones that follow individuals and provide surveillance for days and weeks on end. One, so we can collect the intel to confirm that they're a legitimate target. But two, so that when we decide, if we decide that we are in fact going to kill that individual, we can pick the moment when there's the least potential for harm to others.
I mean, you bring up a good point then. So then sort of the nature of civilians in this sort of combat system or whatever, you know, you do have, you know, what is the responsibility of, you know, do we pick targeting versus, you know, prevention of harm? That really, we're not going to intentionally, there won't be the intentional targeting of civilians.
There cannot be. That would be a war crime.
Exact, right. Versus the principle of prevention of harm. I mm-hmm. mean, what is, which one do we give more credence to? I mean, it seems like, I think you wrote another paper, Fight Right to Fight Well, mm-hmm. General McChrystal's approach to preserving non-combatant immunity, and you make this point that really General McChrystal, he prohibited harming non-combatants, or actually just walk us through this paper because I only read the intro, so
sure.
I might not get the best parts of the paper.
Of course. This is a paper I wrote for Small Wars Journal. If I remember correctly, it came out about April of 2010, and it was a review of the tactical directive that General McChrystal promulgated in 2009, the intent of which, fully consistent with the just war tradition and the understanding of minimizing harm to non-combatants, to civilians. Also fully consistent with the approach to counterinsurgency, which is if you're trying to win over the population, it's probably counterproductive to be killing a whole bunch of them because that's not really going to win their favor.
Right.
What I argued in the paper was that the tactical directive is absolutely consistent with strong just war practices and just prudence. It made good sense. The implementation of the tactical directive perhaps was a little more robust than General McChrystal himself had intended, so that they put no harm of combatants as being the primary goal to be achieved, as opposed to the successful prosecution of the counterinsurgency, which included, by the way, the successful elimination of insurgents.
Right.
The insurgents were clearly harming and clearly intending to harm civilians in Afghanistan for their own purposes. We weren't intending to harm civilians in Afghanistan. That was an unintended side effect of our trying to prosecute insurgents.
So then, I'm curious then, so, for our last point under drone warfare,
mm-hmm.
proportionality. So, I mean, this is where I think, drones really succeed, is that, a drone sort of, it gets, I hate to use popular language, but it gets the job done. It gets it, done with, I would argue, the right amount of force. There's not, to hunt one man, you're not invading a whole region. You're literally putting, throughout our conversation, you've made this great point, at least implicitly, that it does require a lot of intelligence to find, to execute a personality strike. And, it really seems that the harm has been focused just on that individual. So, I mean, do drones sort of satisfy our, traditional, our understandings of proportionality? I mean, what are some of the issues with drones and proportionality? I mean, it seems like this is where drones succeed the most, at least, in a very non-controversial fashion.
Ideally. And again, it all depends. It's a weapon system, so it all depends on how you use the weapon system. But the definition for proportionality in the conduct of war is that the harm of any military action does not outweigh the good to come of achieving the military objective. So what that means is, can I blow up a bridge in order to meet my military objective of isolating a military compound? Well, maybe I can, maybe I can't. What's the effect of blowing up that bridge? How essential is it to me meeting this military objective of isolating the compound? And then you can't ever take proportionality away from discrimination and non-combatant immunity. What's the effect of blowing up that compound on the civilians, or blowing up the bridge with respect to civilians in the area? So I agree with you. Drones absolutely can tip proportionality, can help improve proportionality because it can help pinpoint strikes, limit damage. All of those are military considerations. Where I think the big debate in terms of proportionality and drones comes has nothing to do with military ethics, but it has to do with the policy, the political implications of using drones. You had talked about pushback in Pakistan. We're seeing pushback in Yemen. Drones are not a policy. Drones are an instrument to implement a policy. And I don't know, my hunch is it's case-to-case specific, whether the political consequences of using the political consequences of using signature strikes, the juice might not be worth the squeeze in that instance. What we get from signature strikes might not be worth the political fallout that we're seeing. That's not military ethics, that's just prudence, right?
But in explaining ethics and sort of international law and drones, you've sort of literally deflated the most controversial points of the drone. To somebody in the field, what is the most controversial, like what is the most thought-provoking, you know, part of a drone, if any? It really strikes me as, you know, a lot of the questions and a lot of the answers that you've given us, it really seems like a drone is nothing but a really fancy F-16. Like it basically is fulfilling and repeating the functions that, you know, 20 years ago, you know, let's say the Gulf War, the original Gulf War, that a plane would have done. Like, I mean, you know, especially like, I feel like on Twitter, this is, you know, the greatest critique of drones. Like, you know, really they're just fulfilling, you know, they're repeating and fulfilling the same function that was done by, you know, F-16s 20 years ago, you know, in World War II is the B bomber, the B-2 bomber, so forth and so on. I mean, mm-hmm. I might have my technological history wrong, but I mean, you know, it just really seems like, you know, especially now that you've sort of introduced the legal and ethical sort of debate to us, that it really seems like drones are just fancy planes. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but I would
never tell an F-16 pilot that a drone were a fancy plane, because they might not take that well, but...
I feel like somebody's writing me a letter right now.
Yeah, you're pissing off some pilots.
But I mean...
Two main concerns in the field of military ethics with respect to drones. With respect to just straight-up unmanned systems, the way that we're using them now, you're absolutely right. This is another platform. The advantage that a drone would have over an F-16 pilot is that a drone is a platform in the sky. There are teams of individuals who pilot a drone and who verify the intelligence and who verify the strikes before they happen, as opposed to one or two pilots in a Rio, depending on what the plane is. So you can keep the platforms in the air for longer, reduce fatigue because of the way that they operate the systems. That the ethical concern is you've just facilitated killing. And so the fear is you've made killing more lethal and easier and more justifiable, so we're going to see a lot more killing.
Right.
And that in and of itself is dangerous. The whole just war tradition is about grappling with this tension between a sincere desire for peace and a sincere recognition that sometimes you have to use force to rectify grievances.
So, I mean, but do drones challenge that paradigm, though? Because it seems like, you know, in our conversation, you've been very comfortable with sort of bringing in, like, especially in the paper, The Wizards of War.
Well, that's a good one. I wish I'd called that.
The Wizard of Oz Goes to War. I mean, it very much seems like a lot of the paradigm that you use in that paper, it's very comfortable. Its inheritance is very comfortable from the state. You know, the state-born tradition. So from Walter and some of the older just war theorists, I mean, it seems there's a very much comfortable sinking there. You know, there's no, like, everything, you know, you can draw maybe a straight line and maybe, like, qualify that line, but it's still drones comfortably, at least to me, sort of sit in that tradition. Like, there's still issues, but, I mean, mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily upend and challenge. I mean, the state is the state, the soldier is the soldier, the individual is the individual.
Sure, but the concern would be if the pilots are safely on a military base on U.S. soil, and we can send these weapon systems for days, weeks at a time. You don't keep a drone in the air necessarily for weeks at a time,
right.
But for longer periods of time than you could keep an F-18 up in the air. You've greatly facilitated the country's ability to wage war at a very low cost to itself.
Sort of what Peter Singer said.
And right, correct.
You've basically lowered the bar to the point of you're making it really easy to engage in.
Right, and this is a very real concern. I might be more comfortable with the prudence or the discretion of the United States not to be bloodthirsty in
right.
that way,
of course.
But I can certainly understand why others would find it concerning.
No.
And as we're no longer the only country with drones, I don't necessarily trust China not to be bloodthirsty in the way that they
right.
would use drone warfare.
Now, I'm curious about the pilot, because where do we put the pilot of the drone in terms of... So we consider him a soldier, clearly, because
Potentially. There's civilians who fly drones.
Right. Okay, that's a really interesting question, then. You know, what is our responsibility to the drone pilot in terms of...
Healthcare.
Oh, in terms of... like healthcare infrastructure, in terms of mental health care, because it seems like the person piloting the drone is also involved in combat, right?
Absolutely, without question.
And so, you know, should we be concerned, you know, of the same sort of mental and healthcare costs of combat? Should we say, like, you know, this person flying the, you know, the drone might actually be, you know, somebody who could, you know, not get PTSD, but sort of develop PTSD, or, you know, I mean, because, I mean, like, the healthcare issues are really interesting here, because, you know, clearly they're not in, you know, in danger of being wounded, but they're still, you know, party to combat, so...
Absolutely, and I've seen conflicting reports on this. I've seen reports that indicate that drone pilots have the highest incident rate of PTSD of any occupational specialty within the military, that it is actually challenging for them emotionally and mentally to follow somebody all day while they're at work, potentially kill that individual, and then take their kid to the soccer game and go home and cook dinner at night.
Oh, man.
That for the soldier who's deployed, there is that almost emotional buffer of being away from your family and isolated, and you're with a group that everyone is sharing the same experience, and that's emotionally protective. So the same sort of post-traumatic stress among drone pilots as you would see with EMT or emergency room doctors or those individuals who have this cognitive dissonance of doing one thing that's exceptionally emotionally taxing during the day and then having to go home and be normal. The other thing that I'm almost a little uncomfortable to talk about, but is a real challenge, is that those pilots are targetable. They're targetable by the enemy if they wear the U.S. uniform, so it's an Air Force pilot who is flying the drone, and they're targetable if they're a civilian contractor who's flying the drone. Why? Because they're participating directly in hostilities, and they meet the criteria for being targeted. We've been fortunate. We saw the attack in Afghanistan. We haven't seen an attack here on U.S. soil, but that's a real challenge.
I never thought about that, that the pilot is just as much a combatant as the people he's killing. Okay. So let's sort of switch gears.
Mm-hmm.
So you've really fleshed out, you know, drones and, you know, modern ethics and modern ethics of combat. I don't even... title is crazy, but no, I'm curious if we could switch gears to cyber warfare. And I think this is where, like, it gets murkier, because it's not, because I feel like with drones, everything is sort of, as I've said, like, in neat categories. That, you know, the pilot is wearing the uniform, or he's under contract to the state, there's a combatant, there's a non-combatant. With cyber, everything becomes mush, because not only do you have the state, but you have individuals, individual companies, you know, and, you know, a whole range of tools that aren't necessarily weapons, they're tools.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a lot more sort of, the issue becomes more scrambled, so to speak. So let's just go through the questions again. So how do we define combatancy in a cyber environment? You know, who are the soldiers? You know, do we define soldiers via tools, uniforms, you know, affiliations, or, you know, how do we sort of define combatancy under cyber?
Sure. I would say, I feel like, one, we should maybe give a shout out to the fact that we're in a coffee shop, so that ambient noise are other people enjoying their coffees and lattes and kids having fun. But in terms of who would be a combatant under cyber, it would be the same. The challenge with cyber is measuring effects. And so you could think of a combatant being an individual in a particular country's military who is either, protecting infrastructure or trying to attack infrastructure of another country. What is interesting in how the U.S. government has dealt with cyber is when the administration sent out its cyber strategy, I want to say it was summer of 2011, maybe, or late 2011, they drew a line in the sand and said that significant cyber attacks that cause significant damage to the United States could be, not would be, but could be responded to with force. So we've identified that those individuals, regardless of who they are, if they are members of the military, of former government, of formal governments, individual hackers in their basement, although it's really hard for an individual hacker to execute an attack of the sort that the U.S. government's thinking about. But if they cause damage to U.S. infrastructure or to U.S. livelihood, we could attack them with force in response.
Well, you bring up really two good issues, and I think, so what are we defining as infrastructure, A, mm-hmm. and then B, how do we deal with attribution then?
Because attribution's a huge issue with cyber, for sure.
Right. So, I mean, but with infrastructure then, because in our conversation, I had a conversation with, on our sixth episode, with Pussycat, who is, she's basically a practitioner of cyber warfare, not, I shouldn't say cyber warfare, but she does a lot of exploit testing and a lot mm-hmm. of, you know, cyber in the, you know, offensive set. And she made this really good point, is that as a hacker, you never go after government stuff unless you have a lot of, like, insulation. Like, the target set is always, like, which, you know, squishy, you know, squishies. So mm-hmm. sort of like banks, Best Buy, like, so sort of retail websites. So she made this really great point, is that, you know, the idea is that, you know, you never attack the government, you always attack corporations or individuals. So, I mean, does that expand, I mean, using, you know, the cyber directive as our sort of guide point, I mean, is that literally saying that, you know, everything associated with the United States in any which way is, I mean, we've taken sort of combatancy from a, you know, trimmed down definition to basically include any potential target. I mean, is that, how do we...
Well, combatancy is who is doing the act, right? Okay. So targeting is who is being influenced. Discrimination, non-combat immunity is who do we protect from targeting.
But, I mean, is the bank in that case then...
He might be a target, but he's not a combatant. Okay. Or it might be.
So what happens if the bank sort of responds in kind? So let's say PNC just throws its hands down and says, you know, the feds aren't doing a good job protecting mm-hmm. us from these denial of service attacks that are costing us, you know, $2.5 to $5 million a day. We're just going to go right after, you know...
Cyber vigilantism?
Well, I mean, there's a potential there because, mm-hmm. you know, if you did vigilantism in real life, you'd be, you know, Batman would be a criminal and he would be in federal prison. But if you do, you know, vigilantism in, you know, in cyberspace or, you know, cyber, I mean, you would be considered, I wouldn't say a hero, but it's... People would shrug their shoulders and, you know, not really, I mean, how do we define, like, the bank's role in this case? I mean...
So the difference, there may be two elements to think about. There's defensive cyber and offensive cyber. And it sounds like the woman that you interviewed before made that distinction as well. If PNC were to try to attack and bring down the power grid in eastern China because it found out that that's where the attack on its bank had originated... Then PNC would be acting as a combatant. That would be a big bet. But if PNC is just trying to either take down the systems and the nodes that enabled whatever that group was to attack them in the first place, that would be more maybe defensive cyber. But I don't know, frankly, that the law is defined, certainly international law isn't defined. I don't know if domestic law is defined to the extent that would criminalize either of those two acts. You would just expect that China would retaliate, would respond to the first one more than they might respond to the second one.
I'm curious, like, it's really, you bring up an interesting point with, like, domestic law, because, like you could, like, when people are charged with crimes regarding cyber, like, it's really interesting because, like, Pussycat made this really great point, is that you can, like, hide your trail enough to not be charged with mm-hmm. Illegally accessing a network. So I don't know what the specific charge is, but you won't be charged with that. But, you know, there's a complexity of crime here, complexity of, like, crimes, because then you also have to consider, like, laundering money. And then also, like, a really interesting case was a guy, he got sent to jail for conspiracy charges for selling a tool, which I think is interesting because it's defining somebody as a criminal for, you know, selling a tool that was then used in an attack, which is...
Okay.
So interesting, sort of. But, I mean, going back to our original point, I mean, it seems like, you know, with broadly in theory and ethics theory, is that with cyber, you've expanded, like, every, you know, a whole range of people could have a, you know, be defined as combatant, non-combatant, and it's not really, the categories aren't really neat anymore. Because, like, in our conversation in drones, it was very, everything was not neat, like, you know, clearly organized, but it was, you know, there's categories. Now it seems like in cyber, the categories are very fluid in terms of combatancy, and it really is dependent on, sort of correct me if I'm wrong, but who's acting and who's attacking and who's defending.
So correct.
It could
right.
be an individual, it could be a company, it could be the state, or...
I guess what I would say is, under international law, there are particular definitions of attack, and it typically has to do with violence and concrete physical harm to individuals or infrastructure of a state. So we say cyber attack. We don't really mean attack in that sense that would justify response with force. When Amazon's website gets hacked or those Twitter passwords, that's a cyber attack, but that's not something that you would respond with military force to. What the U.S. government is saying is there are some things that cyber can get to, and it would be as if someone had dropped a bomb on it. Or also another act under international law that would justify military force in response is a naval blockade, right? So if you so isolate an area that they can't meet their basic standards, they can't get food and water and fuel in, they're going to starve and die, you can respond with force to that. So if a cyber attack were to take down the structure of life at a particular part in the United States such so that we could no longer sustain life, then you've crossed the line.
Well, I mean, this might sound silly, but isn't Twitter, Amazon, Facebook part of life? I mean, it seems...
You're not going to die. I mean, you might feel like you're going to die if you don't get your Twitter for a day, right? But you're not going to die. Suck it up.
Right. So, something that I'm curious in, sort of moving away from combatancy into distinction.
Mm-hmm.
How do we, like, distinction, like, it plays into the problem of attribution.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how do we define distinction in this case? I mean,
this is a huge thing. So again, distinction has to do with targeting. Who can you appropriately target? Population-centric targeting, intentionally targeting civilians, off the table.
Right.
With lethal force, I don't know about cyber attacks targeting civilians because you're inconveniencing them. You're not harming them.
Right.
You can use a cyber attack to harm civilians intentionally. That would be an interesting, logically you would say that's off the books. International law hasn't caught up to that yet, so it would be interesting to think how that would play out in fact.
Where do we put anonymous in this case? I mean, it seems like they do commit crimes.
They sure violate U.S. law.
Right. So, I mean, where do we put, like, in terms of anonymous? Like, do we consider them to be... Like, I think anonymous really, like, sort of shows this problem in... you know, droves, because, like, so anonymous doesn't make the distinction between government and individual sites,
mm-hmm.
but the state is required to do so, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because
sure.
cyber directives and the law, but also, like, anonymous, like, we don't really know their structure very well, because anybody could sort of be anonymous. So how do we... You know, how does distinction work in this case? I mean...
Well, anonymous would be a law enforcement issue, not a military issue. So the just war tradition or law of war wouldn't apply to them the same way.
Okay.
And the reason I would say that this is a law enforcement issue and not a military issue is because they're not actually... It's attacking the cracking network, but they're not causing harm to individuals. There's no destruction of property. There might be violations of intellectual property. We might know... that some individuals who were identified in the cables that were taken by Anonymous, that their lives are put in jeopardy, but that's an indirect culpability for those deaths. Anonymous isn't targeting those individuals. So the court system handles that in the United States and internationally.
So then,
we wouldn't target what's his nut who runs Anonymous. We wouldn't target him to kill him. We would prosecute him under different sorts of domestic laws that he's violated.
So then... what happens if a state, you know, sort of uses Anonymous's methodology? So we saw that the attacks on the banks,
mm-hmm.
you know, they were being attributed to Iran. And so, and I think there's a strong, you know, lot of evidence to say that, you know, people who were sort of targeting the banks, PNC, Wells Fargo, they were Iranians. Because you can go to their paste bin, you can sort of track out... you know, the organization. So I'm curious, in the case of denial of service attacks, do you know, do we, you know, retaliate? Does this, is the state responsible for retaliation, or is it the issue of whoever is being attacked?
I think, I don't know that the state is responsible for retaliation, or that the state would see retaliation as being prudent. Remember, there's an ethical discussion, and then there's the, like, what makes good sense discussion.
Right.
I don't know that retaliating against Iran for attacks on PNC, if that in fact happened, I don't know that that's really what's in our best interest to do. What I would say is, certainly the United States government is developing capacity to protect U.S. industry against those attacks. Absolutely, the corporations themselves are beefing up firewalls and adopting protocols to help protect them against attacks. It was a big thing when DHS came out and said, take all your, what was the software that they said that you need to?
Java.
Java, thanks. I need more Java today to remember the freaking name. That was a big thing for the government to say. There is proprietary software out there on your computers that are leaving you vulnerable. You should consider uninstalling that and not using it. And my understanding is that that Java vulnerability is what allowed the hackers to get the Twitter accounts this week, or the passwords from the Twitter accounts this week. So I think we've seen good coordination between the government and businesses. But again, none of that, in my argument, I don't know what the U.S. government has set as the threshold to say this is dangerous enough to American citizens and property that we will consider that an act of war and we will seek to respond in kind. That's classified. I don't know where that line is. But my own intuitive sense would be the attacks we've seen so far just don't meet that threshold.
But, I mean, it really seems like the lines are really blurred in terms of distinction because, I mean, so I think it... So basically, I mean, if we go back and sort of say, like, the NSA's role in protecting networks, or, you know, the DOJ's role in protecting networks, or the DISA, that's the Defense Intelligence, like, the guys responsible for DOD IT.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, but it seems like, you know, those three responsibilities, NSA, DOJ, and the Defense, you know, Defense Department's own IT department, they really... they're not always using public networks, they're also using private networks. So so if we go back and think about this, sort of there's a good relationship between the telecoms companies, technology companies, and, you know, NSA, DOJ, whomever. Because, I mean, even if you go back through the history of the NSA, you know, it was started by, you know, Comstock, who was, you know, the Electric Teal Corporation. I won't bore you with the history, but, I mean, it seems like my point is that distinction, it really has become blurred, because... There's the public networks that are the states, and then there's private networks that are companies.
So are you suggesting that those private networks are now legitimate targets because they support the state, because the state uses them for their purposes?
I have, like, I mean, that's my issue, because...
Okay, but...
It really seems like, because there's such a blur of public and private, like, how do we create an ethical paradigm for military thinkers? I mean, it seems like, you know, is it really the responsibility of the NSA to also protect private networks?
Well, I mean, I would suggest it's the responsibility of the NSA to protect whatever it is the President and Congress tells it to protect.
But
respect to the heart of your question, we already have this in the physical world. I talked about bridges, blowing up a bridge before to isolate a military compound. Civilians probably use that bridge too. Right? The telecommunication towers that facilitate command and control for militaries, maybe not in the U.S., but in some countries, are the same towers that facilitate communication for the civilian population. There are some clear no-goes in terms of hospitals, religious sites, schools where you are not allowed to target, and that's it, right? But there's a lot of the dual-use infrastructure in countries that are legitimate targets, depending on how they're being used at the time and the potential for civilian harm if you do target them. My hunch is, and I haven't fleshed this out, but my hunch is smart people are fleshing it out right now, in terms of cyberspace, you would have that same kind of dual-use system. So I don't know that we need a new paradigm. I think you're right. It's murkier, mostly because people are less aware of... that bleed over, you can see a bridge and you can see a military truck go over it, and then you can see a school bus go over it. It's kind of hard to see how how cyberspace and telecommunication, how all the stuff that facilitates communication and transit of funds and goods and knowledge, and how all that stuff fits together. You got to be pretty expert to understand it. But I think the principles are probably the same.
So I'm curious, and sort of for our last little bit, proportionality.
Mm-hmm.
What is, because I feel like in information security that, like, I can't really put my feet down and say something is proportional because it's so, there's so many variables here, because mm-hmm. you could say, you know, a proportional response could be literally cutting off the internet, you know, mm-hmm. shutting down information flow and, you know, going after a target, or it could be, you know, the exact opposite, which is open up, you know, sort of all the spigots of information and see what comes up. So I'm curious, like, how do we define proportionality? Like, you know, how do we define the state's response? And is it, you know, that right response to get the job done? I mean, in terms of, you know, the ethical sort of mm-hmm. description you laid out earlier.
Yeah, well, again, I don't think the definition changes. I think what changes is how you figure out the calculation, right? So the definition would be the same. Is the military advantage of this particular action proportionate with the harm that's going to be caused by the action? And if the military advantage, if the harm to the of the act doesn't outweigh the benefit to come of the act, then you're good to go. But in terms of all the extra variables that you identify, it's a complex problem, without question.
So then how do we define harm then? Because this really bugs me, because mm-hmm. we've made some really good points that, you know, hacking somebody's Twitter isn't
inconvenient.
It's you know, you're becoming an inconvenience in hacking somebody's Twitter, hacking somebody's Facebook, hacking, you know, the NYT, but, you know, I mean, it seems like cyber really deals with an informational space.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, not necessarily an attack space, but sort of, you know, egressing, you know, information. I think egress is the right verb. But, you know, moving information out of a system, you know, it doesn't necessarily cause physical harm.
Right.
You know, if I lose my social security number and, you know, my medical information, you know, it's not really doing, in, like, the digital act is not doing harm to me, but it might be integrated into a physical act. So,
correct.
I mean, if we think about it in terms of the state, you know, knowing that how Iran structures its, you know, the information how Iran structures its nuclear program, you know, might not necessarily, you know, the act of moving that information from one system to the next might not do physical harm,
mm-hmm.
but it's certainly doing some sort of harm. So I'm curious then, you know, do we complexify our understanding of harm, you know, to not only include the physical, but also sort of the inconvenient and sort of the informational?
Well, I would say, and again, I can't speak for the U.S. government on this because I don't know where they're coming down on
right,
it.
Of course.
I would have a hard time accepting that inconvenience would be a legitimate standard for the United States of America to do much of anything, or frankly for any state, because what you're talking about is once you cross a particular threshold, the U.S. government or the French government or the Iranian government would consider that an act of war and would retaliate either with another a commensurate cyber attack or, as the U.S. has said, with actual lethal force. So the definition of harm would have to be substantial enough that it would threaten vital U.S. national interest in order to spark a response in kind. And I think you're absolutely right, though. The concern would be if somebody steals your Social Security number, I mean, that's scary, but what makes it scary is they can empty your bank accounts.
Right.
They can trash your credit record. They can get access to your medical records and figure out that you've got a pacemaker that they can hack from outside and kill you on the spot, right? I mean, that their actual physical harm responses to the information harm of having your information taken.
So, I mean, do we sort of blend the two then? Sort of, you know, we have to sort of define proportionality, you know, as sort of a tiered system where we have to judge, you know, the acquisition of information versus the potential physical harm. I mean, do we have to complexify our understanding then? I mean, because it really seems like cyber is, it's about second and third tier consequences as
sure.
opposed to, you know, a drone blowing up a village. Instead, you know, using cyber, you would, you know, gain information about those people in the village and their, you know, Excel spreadsheets and their, you know, patterns, and then it leads to, I mean, you know what I mean?
So. Sure. I think that makes sense to me. But again, for me, the standard is what constitutes a vital threat to U.S. national interest. When we think of just cause, there's a whole set of causes what would justify a response with force. And it's not enough, frankly. It's not enough to meet the just cause criteria in the just war tradition. It's not enough to meet the just war or the just cause criteria. You also have to meet the other criteria having to do with reasonable chance of success, last resort, proportionality, right intention. So let's say that there was a cyber attack that we thought met sufficient harm that it was a threat to vital U.S. national interest. But we weren't entirely sure who was responsible for it. So reasonable chance of success, we don't really know. How could we know that we had vindicated our national interest with a commensurate cyber attack or even a physical attack using force or weapons or soldiers? And since we can't really identify who it is who's responsible for it, we can't really evaluate proportionality because we don't really know if the good of responding is going to outweigh the damage done by responding for all the reasons that you just mentioned, that it's hard to identify who's responsible. It's hard to identify the second and third order effects if we were to respond. Civilians would more than likely be wrapped up in a response more so than they would with, you know, F-18s dropping bombs on a particular military target. So absolutely, this is a big question.
Okay. So I think you've explained it very well. So let's sort of switch to the more social aspect of sort of ethics, sort of social media and sort of ethics. I think this is a really underdefined sort of, you know, portion, because, you know, everybody uses social media, and you're not just talking about, you know, 14-year-old girls, you know, I went to the mall, yay! But rather, you know, from my own personal experience, you know, you do have cleared professionals, mm-hmm. you know, people in government, people who are contracting, etc. So I'm curious, and do we, you know, my first question is, do we have to develop sort of a ethical and responsibility paradigm for social media? Like, not just for cleared professionals, but also for individuals who want to sort of engage in the medium, you know, without over-engaging or without, you know, I don't know, being a victim to phishing DMs. I don't know. But I mean, my point is that, you know, how do we define ethics and responsibility when it comes to social media usage?
Sure. I think there's the personal security element of it that I wish people paid more attention to. And there's the responsible engagement, judgment piece of it that, frankly, I wish people would pay a little more attention to. Not just cleared individuals, but anybody, right? I tell my students and I tell my colleagues, you guarantee that if you're active on Twitter, people are watching you. Guarantee someone from foreign intel, if you identify yourself as a member of the United States military and you have a Twitter account, you can just expect that foreign intelligence is monitoring your activity. Accept it. Don't let it freak you out, but accept it and let that shape the way that you engage. Don't put a picture of yourself in uniform with your name and rank. Don't put pictures of your kids online. Like, let's not be stupid about it. Don't tweet about ongoing operations. One, because it's a striking violation of operational security, but two, it's just stupid and you're going to get people you care about killed.
So then I'm curious then, how do we balance, you know, public engagement with privacy?
Sure.
Because it seems like, you know, this was a big thing for WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks or leaks?
Leaks.
Leaks. Because they were, you know, I don't agree with them, but, you know, in the beginning, their mantra was, you know, we're going to make all secrets open. So I'm curious then, sort of, my first question is, how do we balance, you know, being public versus inherent, you know, protection of information and privacy? So not only are you protecting classified information, but also privacy as an individual. And then, you know, sort of, you know, how do we think about WikiLeaks? Because it seems like, you know, on a first layer, they do have a noble project, which is, you know, secrets. You know, the more open a society is, the more democratic it is. But then, in practice, you know, they fail because, you know, as they made stuff more open, you know, we sort of realize that there is a reason why there's, you know, protection of information and secrets. So, sort of guide us through this.
Sure. I reject the premise that more information is better in a democracy. I understand the impulse, but we can't talk theoretically about democracy. I think we should be talking about democracy in the United States. Democracy is a cornerstone of our way of life, but so is the rule of law. And where I would argue WikiLeaks was way out of line wasn't in the intention of, let's facilitate civil discussion of the way our government works. That's great. That is a fundamental responsibility of every American. But we do so legally. They broke U.S. law, clearly, without question. And so for me, you can't build up one principle by violating another core principle. So what we have in the United States is there is the prudential or the common sense question of how do we live in an open society that fosters discussion among the population, because that's how our democratic republic works, with the fact that there are things that our state does to keep us safe that we can't talk about publicly. That's a real question. But saying, ah, to hell with it, we're just going to put all the information out there and people will sort it out, is not the answer, because it violates a core foundation of who we are as a country. So we've got to balance these three, security, rule of law, democracy, as we think about the answer.
So I'm curious then, sort of, you know, how do we balance then, like sort of, when it comes to Twitter and when it comes to, you know, does it start at the level of an individual, or again, is it, you know, sort of individuals, organizations, and the state? I mean, like, how does privacy work? I mean, you know, what can we define as what we want private and what isn't private and what is public? I mean, because it seems like social media has really, like, brought this argument out in the open, because, you know, you do point out sort of operational security and personal security, but, I mean, if your job is to monitor Twitter...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even by engaging that medium, you're putting out information that can lend itself to analysis. I mean, but it seems...
If your job is to monitor social media, and so you do that by engaging and not just reading certain people's Twitter feeds, there's this really awesome thing called disinformation that you can use, right? You can have a fake account, and people are trained on how to do this. You can have a fake account that isn't connected to you in any meaningful way. You develop an online persona that isn't actually who you are, and you cultivate relationships with those people you're trying to monitor and follow and exploit, ultimately, right? Most of the time, you're not just monitoring them. You want to get something from them.
So do you think deception is inherent to the medium then?
Because I don't think it has to be, but I think, in fact, many people use it that way. Sure.
So what is the responsibility of the individual to be, like, truthful? I mean, it seems like social media really, like, has made... you know, the definition of truth and what is, you know, a lie. I mean, you know, clearly there's, you know, definitions at the extreme, like, you know, saying that you're a 6'3" supermodel is clearly, you know, is a lie. But sort of, I mean, I feel like in the middle, you know, there's a weird case being made for, you know, information, disinformation, truth and lies that are really... you know, it really depends on the individual and sort of the medium itself. So, I don't know. I mean, I find it really, like, sort of a fascinating thing in terms of intelligence, because you're right, like, it's just this constant flow of information, disinformation, and it's happening in real time.
Sure. Well, and I think the fact that it's happening in real time is part of what makes it vulnerable to be exploited. It's one thing if I see an email or see something on the internet and I can think about it and I can sort of fact check it, but the way the conversations tend to work on Twitter, there's a lot of back and forth and people are reacting more than they're responding. And that can lead you to be, you can believe something that's not true. I've done that myself. I see a story on Twitter and I think it's right, so I retweet it, come to find out it's wrong, I look like an idiot. That's life. But you either have to be experienced enough and disciplined enough to be careful about doing that, or you leave yourself open to exploitation. I mean, without question, that's just the reality of it.
So really, it's just a matter of personal responsibility, because it really seems like it's all about the individual user and sort of how they engage the medium, as opposed to, you know, more complex arguments about the company or the state or whatever.
I think, well, I mean, you've got companies and you've got states who are engaged in Twitter as well. So I would say it's probably different conversations I work for the U.S. government, so I'm a U.S. I'm a federal employee working for the Marine Corps. There's the Becky Johnson, me side of it, and then there's the professional side of it. But when I'm on Twitter, I represent both, regardless. Even if it were, even if my Twitter account had nothing to do with what I do professionally, it's just the fact that no matter what I do, 24/7, people look at me, and if they know where I work, they see U.S. government. I would be an idiot to assume that that were different.
So do you think social media is a sort of equalizer in the sense that the state has to engage in a medium of exchange that is the same for a corporation, that is the same for the individual? I mean, right, the state has resources beyond Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
PNC has resources beyond Twitter. The individual has resources and recourse beyond Twitter. But, I mean, it seems like as a medium, it really does sort of... I'll put equalizing quotes, but it really does seem to bring everybody down to the same level, that everybody's forced to discuss and to engage and to sort of...
Well, and I think we see that. I think we see very positive benefits to that. You know, Cory Booker's Twitter feed is amazing to me, how he just reaches out and talks to his constituents and gives them his phone number, and they, he fixes parking problems for them, and, like, actual, they're out of heat and they're cold and it's 10 degrees outside, and he gets the city out there to help them. Or Mike McFaul, the U.S. ambassador to Russia, runs his own Twitter feed. He engages with American citizens as the ambassador to Russia. The U.S. embassy in Pretoria has a very... robust Twitter, as of a few months ago, very robust Twitter account. That's awesome. I think that's a very useful way to talk about transparency and democracy and open exchange, civic communication. That's a responsible, rule of law based way to foster that sort of interaction.
Do you think it also? Do you think it also empowers individuals? Because it seems like a lot of the sort of the revolution in Syria is playing out on Twitter.
Sure.
So every time there's an attack, a successful rebel attack, it's a YouTube, you know, a YouTube video is produced, put on Twitter. I mean, it seems like, it really seems for the individual, it does really empower them in terms of at least messaging. I mean, you know.
Sure. Frontline SMS, I think, is a great example of this. I feel like the first time I really saw it was with the Mumbai attacks back in, was it 2009 that happened, I feel like?
Yeah, 2009, 2010.
And so absolutely kind of the citizen communication, real-time reporting of events, hugely beneficial. The flip side of that, of course, is the use of disinformation. We sort of assume when we get reports on the ground that it's an individual in Syria who is seeing this thing and is communicating honestly what's going on from their perspective, right?
What about unintentional disinformation? Like, I remember, was it Sandy Hook? Like... One of these recent shootings that, like, the journalists who were reporting were really irresponsible when it came to Twitter, because either they were saying things that were not right, or they were putting pictures of, like, children.
Misidentified the shooter. I mean, that's kind of a big thing. And I feel for the individual.
So we just have to sort of be critical in our approach then.
I think we have to, yes.
As with any sort of social exchange.
Well, I think we have to be careful on two sides. For the individuals who are on Twitter sharing that information, use your common sense to think about, he's a very upset little boy and he's having a lot of fun.
Not agree with us.
You have to be very careful in what you share. But from the consumer side, I think we also have to be charitable that as crises like these unfold, the story's going to change. Of course the story's going to change because we learn about what's happening as time moves forward. What was true at the 2 seconds after the event happened, you're going to learn more 5 minutes after and then 2 days after. And so I've noticed some criticism of the real-time reporting. Part of that is being responsible, but part of that is just also recognizing the reality that stories are going to flesh out. People's perspectives, particularly in traumatic events, will be wrong. And it takes time to figure out what actually happened.
How dependent are we as social media users on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Pinterest, whatever you know, social media you use? How dependent are we as an individual on them to ensure our privacy? Because it seems like Twitter, this isn't really... With Twitter, it's not an issue because they don't really do a lot of advertising. At least, they don't do a lot of blunt advertising. But it seems like with Facebook, they're constantly accessing your information. Like, I was the other day, I'm beta testing Graph.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for those who don't know, Graph is this, what I think is a really hyper-intrusive sort of search function, because no longer are you searching based on name, but based on gender, interests, age, you know, friends, like, for example, like what Chelsea and I searched was friends who like Indian food. So it will list all your friends that like Indian food, which, I mean, that search is rather benign, but...
Sure.
You know, a lot of the InfoSec community, they're coming out and saying, well, this is a social hacker. You literally made social engineering that much easier. So I'm curious, and to go back to the question, you know, how reliant are we as individuals on Facebook, Twitter, whomever, to defend our privacy, to sort of ensure that as cleared individuals, you know, or as, you know, as individuals, that these corporations, these companies will protect, you know, ensure that our personal data isn't, you know, it's being shielded away from our online identity.
Well, I would suggest that we should have no expectation that our personal information is being protected by anyone other than ourselves, right? I mean, again, we can have a discussion about whether that's right or wrong, but the reality is Facebook's trying to make money. How do they make money? Through advertising. How do they sell to advertisers? Identifying personal information. Same thing's true on Google advertisements in my Gmail account. I mean, that is what it is what it is. So if you want to protect yourself, don't access those technologies. We could, as Americans, lobby Congress to pass a law to make those sorts of actions illegal.
Right.
Facebook, Google would then have every incentive to put their smart people to work to try to figure out, well, if we can't do this, then what else can we do to make money off of individual information?
So then, as a cleared professional, then, how do you, like, it seems like, going back to our original point, like, how do we balance wanting to engage in social media, but also the fact that whatever data we put in our Twitter account, personal data, so not, this is private, essentially your name, email address, whatever, your location. How do we ensure that Twitter or Facebook, like, is there, like, more layers of deception now? Because not only is our public face, you know, deceiving, you know, the information we put out is not only deceptive, but also we have to sort of use a fake identity in order to deal with...
Well, I don't think your public face needs to be deceptive. I am who I am. I don't lie on Twitter because I have no reason to lie on. I might not share everything... I don't hit send with every impulse I've got for things I want to tweet, right? I mean, I use discretion. But I think you can be honest and truthful in who you are. But I would say, if you don't have a separate email account for your Twitter account, and then have a separate email account and sign in and password for your Facebook, and for your, then you're stupid, right? I mean, you've got to be careful yourself to compartmentalize that information, and you've got to be careful in terms of what you post to begin with. So I won't put anything on social media that people don't already know about me. I don't divulge. People know I went to the University of Texas. This is not rocket science. Any idiot can find out that I'm a Longhorn. So I tweet about Longhorn football. People know I like beer. So I tweet about beer. But none of this is going to compromise national security. I think you've got to be really... They know I have two dogs.
Right.
All right. Great. You know, no one's going to invade the country on the basis of my telling Twitter I've got two dogs. You've got to be careful about the sorts of things you put out there.
But I mean,
because you just can't have any expectation that anything you put out there will be safe.
But I mean, do you think there's danger in sort of benign information? I mean, it seems like, I don't know, like...
Sure. The way that it's dangerous is that someone who was looking to exploit me would saddle up to me as a Longhorn and try to build a connection that way. Right, or talk about their love for dogs and think that somehow I'm going to have some kind of affection for them. And so this is another responsibility that we have. You'd be stupid if you think that I'm going to give you anything on the basis of your being a Longhorn or from Texas.
So it really is, it's all about personal security and sort of the individual trying, you know, navigating this network intelligently.
Well, and frankly, I think everything we do in life is about personal security, personal responsibility. We're all responsible for our actions 24/7, and let's just own that. Let's not make a fuss about it. But it, I mean, that just is, particularly for adults. This is the truth. You're a grown, bleeping adult. Act like it.
Of course. So I think that was it. I mean, I think we hit on everything. Do you want to mention anything else? Oh, Metsy. That's right.
That's right.
So you're... What is METC?
Military Ethics Twitter Course.
Oh, that makes sense.
So I teach at the Command and Staff College. We're in the elective period, and I'm teaching the course on military ethics now. It's 10 classes over 2 weeks, or 10 classes over 5 weeks, so 2 classes a week. And I just thought it would be kind of fun to see if the folks on Twitter would want to talk about the same sorts of issues I'm talking about in the classroom. We've had some pretty good conversations so far. I've been incredibly impressed with it.
What is it? So basically you take the class material and just put it on Twitter, or how does this...
Sort of. So I have my own personal blog, and so on the blog I posted the readings.
Oh, what's the...
Endeavor to Persevere.
Okay.
I'll
put it up.
Anyone who likes Westerns and knows Outlaw Josie Wales understands where that comes from. But, so, I put the readings up on my website, and each topic session, so professional military ethic is where we started, I just wrote a blog post that outlined the content of what that subject matter is about, tweeted links to the blog post, tweeted the readings, and then... At night, I pick a discussion question that sort of fits that topic, tweet the discussion question with the hashtag, and anybody who wants anywhere on the World Wide Web can engage in the conversation.
Now, I mean, this sounds silly, but is the university, do they take issue with that? I mean, it seems, like, I remember when I was doing my undergrad, like, a lot of, they would be very protective of their syllabus, like, you really can't take this outside of class. I mean, but... Is the university sort of supportive of...
Absolutely, yes. And I think for a couple of reasons. One of the benefits of being a government organization is there is no... I mean, you've got security issues, but there's no real intellectual property. I can't sell my syllabus, right? The U.S. government can't profit off of this information. So that concern is alleviated. But more importantly, we're talking about military ethics. The university, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has tweeted and posted on his Facebook wall about METSI. There's a real desire for service members to think about the ethical implications of their actions, recognizing the overwhelming majority of service members are good, moral individuals who want to do the right thing and want to lead their troops well. But having a conversation about what that means and the different facets of it's important.
As an educator, do you think Twitter is useful? Because, I don't know, as a researcher and an analyst, I find Twitter sort of difficult to use. Not difficult to use, but in the sense that, like, when we wanted to do research on the 2009 sort of the protests in Iran, so you do hashtag Green Movement or hashtag 2009, and... One of the things I hate about Twitter, I hate it, like, there's no permanence in the tweets. So as a researcher, you can't dig deep into the material. Or you're limited to the last 3,200 tweets of whoever you're researching or whatever hashtag you're researching. Now, I mean, the caveat is that as an individual, I can access my own tweets now and look at all 60,000 tweets that I have produced. So, I mean, as an educator and then as a researcher, you know, what do you see the limits of Twitter as an educational tool? Given that, like, there's no, you know, I'm going to put this in quotes, but there's no real... Twitter isn't an object of permanence. The data isn't necessarily treated as permanent.
This is something I've struggled with a little bit, because the conversations on METSI, they get really intense in the evenings when folks are home from work, and then you sort of lose it the next day because your timeline goes down and you just don't see the stuff anymore. Storify helps with that because that makes permanent. You can capture particular conversations. But I think the way I've reconciled it is to say, when I'm sitting around a seminar table with my students, we have a conversation for 2 hours. People might take notes, but we're engaged in the conversation, and then we leave, and then it's gone. You don't videotape and archive all of your seminar conversations. So it doesn't really bother me, the lack of permanence of the Twitter conversations, because that's exactly how it would be if we were sitting around a table talking.
But I would push back and say... Our conversations at the seminar table are not, like, history. Like, this was, I think Mark Lynch brought it up, like scholars of the Middle East, like, literally, you know, the Arab Spring has played out over Twitter, you know, and then going back, the Iranian Revolution, or the Green Movement, you know, whatever, played out live over Twitter in 2009. And even, like, you know, when I started, you know, doing the research for, you know, Africa Month on the Loopcast, you know, Mali, Kenya, Somalia, like, all of that is history. You know, the critique is that it's first-person history, so really you have to really be stringent on, you know, multiple sourcing and fact-checking. But,
sure.
I mean, it just seems like whole swaths of historical data are just gone. I mean, like, but, you know, I don't mean to, like, denigrate, but, like, the seminar is just, you know, one of a thousand conversations you'll have. You know, it might be of consequence, it might not be, but, like, you know,
well, sure.
The Arab Spring is, like, large pieces of that historical data.
I absolutely agree with
gone.
You. Right, but if I perhaps misunderstood, I thought you were asking me about Twitter for educational purposes, in which case I'm fine with it. But I think you're absolutely right that for a research or historical purpose, it's the sort of thing that you would want in the Library of Congress, right? And Twitter clearly has the capacity because it has captured that information for every user. The question would be who would have the ability and the authority to collate or bring together those particular historical moments. And I would say hashtags aren't sufficient because we all know people tweet all sorts of things without the appropriate hashtag. You would need to do kind of a vacuuming up of all of the information from particular places in a particular time date range.
And it's that's such an awful way to research too, because okay, so I'm beginning to realize that outside of the neat little box of NatSec Twitter and InfoSec Twitter and, like, regional specialists, like, outside that box is that Twitter is a very weird place.
I think that's probably true.
I don't
spend a lot of time out on the real Twitter.
it's very, I think, like, to sort of end the conversation, it's very useful as a research tool, as a conversation tool, as an analysis tool, but it's also very, like, clicky. Like, really, if somebody were to examine, you know, the guests on the Loopcast, take them about 5 minutes to realize these are the people that I tweet at constantly or read their material. And it's, you know, if you take two steps to the left, suddenly you realize Twitter is a lot of younger people tweeting about stuff that I have no idea what it is, like pop music. Anyway, I'm sorry, just digression. But so Metsy, hashtag METC, endeavor to persevere, and then anything else? I mean, any you'd like to bring up? I mean,
no, I think
at least
been a lot
five
of fun.
People listen to this.
I've got a hunch they're not going to hear much because of all the ambient noise. We'll have to reshoot it like in another week or whatever. but no, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much.